Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with me, Dr. Kiki Sanford. Episode number 119, recorded Thursday, November 3rd, 2011. All kinds of brains. This episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Ford, featuring voice-activated Sync App Link. Now you can control select smartphone apps with your voice, so you keep your hands on the wheel and your eyes on the road. Check it out in the 2012 Ford Fiesta and at Ford.com/technology. And by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to Netflix.com/twit. Welcome, everyone, to Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. I'm Dr. Kiki, and this is the hour that you are used to getting one expert in one topic for the entire hour. Well, today is a little bit different thanks to the Bay Area Science Festival, which is going on all week this week in the Bay Area. So if you are in the Bay, take some time to stop and smell the science. Go to bayareascience.org and check out the schedule and see if there's anything, any events going on for the rest of the week that fit into your schedule. But I hope you're ready for this week's show, because thanks to the Bay Area Science Festival, it's not one, no, not just one, but two guests today in two different topic areas, both of them revolving around the brain and behavior. Our first guest will be on the science of music and your brain, Dr. Daniel Levitin. Second guest will be on the science of animal smarts with Dr. Diana Rice. But first, before we get going, a few science headlines. Using a molecule called chitosan, isolated from the shells of crustaceans, University of Washington researchers have taken us one step closer to becoming cyborgs. Their invention, described in Nature Communications, is a solid-state biocompatible device that solves many problems of interfacing electronics with organic tissue. Dr. Greg Homer from Stroma Medical in California says he can turn your brown eyes blue with the help of his specially tuned laser. The laser destroys the brown pigment cell containing cells in the eye, and it might be true, but consider for a moment that he has a PhD in economics and biology, not a medical doctor, and that he works as an entertainment lawyer. Things that make me go, Research published in the journal Physical Review Letters suggests that in the physics of our universe, one ring might not rule them all. Instead, it appears that the rules of physics might be localized. The team from the University of New South Wales report finding variation in the strength of electromagnetism across the universe, getting stronger in one direction and weaker in the other. The findings have implications for chemical interactions and the evolution of life in other galactic neighborhoods. NASA scientists report the first observation of a star with spiral arms. Known as SAO206462, the young star is more than 400 light years from Earth in the constellation Lupus, the Wolf, and has a circumstellar disk of material surrounding it. While not yet visible, the spiral arms suggest the gravitational pull of planets, which would confirm computer model simulations of star formation. Tomorrow, November 4th, marks the end of the Mars 500 experiment. The six crew members will be released from their isolation after 520 days, the length of the trip to Mars. French researchers suggest that the fabled sunstone, said to be used by Viking navigators, was actually a calcite crystal called Iceland spar. The transparent light depolarizing crystal is readily found in Viking territory, making it a likely culprit. A 94-million-year-old mouse-sized fossil with very large fangs was found in Argentina, called Chronopio denticutus. The primitive mammal probably used the fangs to skewer insects. Aside from the fact that it's been extinct for about 60 million years, I might think it made an appearance in Monty Python's Search for the Holy Grail. It's got big fangs. big thanks. New genetic findings published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences suggest that up to 1% of the genetic makeup of people in southern China could have come from the Denisovan lineage, which was possibly a second human species. And in a breakthrough study from the Mayo Clinic published in Nature, scientists extended the health of aging mice by flushing dying cells out of their tissues. The genetically modified mice were designed to age quickly and die from heart attack, but when given a drug trigger, expel dying cells from fatty tissues, muscles, and eyes. The mice experienced the ravages of aging until given the trigger, at which point muscle wasting stopped, cataracts stopped forming, and health was maintained. Until their hearts gave out. And that does it for the science headlines this week. This episode of Dr. Kiki Science Hour is brought to you by Ford, featuring available voice-activated Sync App Link. Sync App Link enables you to control select apps from your smartphone with simple voice commands while you keep your hands on the wheel and your eyes on the road. With Sync App Link, you can do things like voice control Pandora in your car. Listen to your tweets with open beak just by asking with a simple voice command. Once your smartphone is linked to Pandora, for example, you can use voice commands to select your favorite stations or make a new one, bookmark songs to purchase, and give songs a thumbs up or a thumbs down. Some of the voice commands include play station classic rock, bookmark song, thumbs up or thumbs down. And with open beak, for example, you can simply say read timelines or read replies. Sync App Link is built on an API platform that allows Ford to continue to work with developers in the app community to bring apps to life with voice in their vehicles. Voice-activated Sync App Link is available in the 2012 Ford Fiesta. You can learn more about this and other technologies Ford is bringing to its vehicles at ford.com/technology. And Twit Sunday Barbecues are brought to you by Ford, and Ford is helping us bring together at our studio upcoming barbecues. Twit Sunday barbecues are scheduled for Sunday, November 13th and Sunday, December 4th, starting at 1:30 p.m. We have a chance to meet, eat, and maybe check out some new Fords too, and you'll have the seats to watch us record Twit in studio. If you'd like to join us, please go to twit.tv to request tickets. We'd love to see you here at the studio, and thanks to Ford for bringing us the Twit Sunday barbecues. Now, without any further ado, I'd like to bring in our guest expert for the show, the first part of the show. Our first guest today is a prominent American cognitive psychologist, neuroscientist, record producer, musician, and writer. He is currently James McGill Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Neuroscience at McGill University in Montreal, Quebec, Canada, with additional appointments in music theory, computer science, and education. All this I gleaned from Wikipedia. He's also published scientific articles on absolute pitch, music cognition, and neuroscience, and is more widely known as the author of two best-selling books, This Is Your Brain on Music, The Science of Human Obsession, of a Human Obsession, and The World in Six Songs, How the Musical Brain Created Human Nature. Dr. Levitin, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Kiki.
You're welcome. Okay, so tonight, you are a part of the Bay Area Science Festival, and you're going to be speaking on the topic of your more recent book, This Is Your Brain on Music. What are you hoping in the you know, hour and a half or so that you've got an audience to discuss the topic with? What are you hoping to get across to everyone about music and our brains?
Well, I'm really excited because I'm going to be joined at the event on stage at the Commonwealth Club by a friend of mine who is one of my favorite guitarists and composers, Alex DeGrassi. He actually lives up in your neck of the woods, up near Ukiah. And Alex and I are going to talk about the creative process and how musicians do what they do, where they find their inspiration and their style, whether musical ability comes from genetics or from practice. And it's going to be a free-ranging conversation that we haven't choreographed. We're just going to improvise.
It sounds like fun. And for two people who are very involved in music, improvisation probably isn't going to be too much of a problem there.
I think it'll be fun for everybody.
Yeah.
And Alex, it's play, too.
Oh, he's going to play also?
Yeah.
Oh, that'll be neat. I'm wondering from, you know, your interest in music, you've been, you know, interested in music your entire life, starting out as an audio engineer and working in the musical field. Now it's a part of your scientific work. At what point in your life was the turning point that you decided that instead of just making music, you wanted to study music and the brain?
I don't know that there was a turning point, but I was doing some recordings up at Prairie Sun Studios in Cotati, and I was having a great time and just thinking more and more about where musicians get their ideas and how they do what they do. I mean, I'm a musician myself, but the idea of trying to sort out how much of it is in the fingers and how much of it in the brain, how much of it is in you.
Oh, we froze for a second. He must have moved too much. Hopefully we will call him back and get him back on to finish answering that question. In the meantime, I will remind everybody that we are in the middle of Bay Area Science Festival and starting tonight at 7:30 at the Commonwealth Club is when Daniel Levitin is going to be speaking. Kai is sad a lot today. Kai wants to, Golda Zader in the chat room is saying that Kai is sad that he froze. I'm sad as well. I hope that he makes it back soon. We'll take this opportunity to drink tea. Jasmine green tea.
I'm getting no answer, so it may be.
Oh, no. That's no good. That was really interesting. I'm really tired today. So very tired.
We need our interlude music while we wait.
There. That's good. It might put me to sleep, though.
Here we go.
Yay!
I will try not to move.
That's what I was going to ask. Thank you. So you were answering the question about whether the music is genetics, whether it's happening in our brains or in our fingers. And then I think that's about where you broke off.
And there was a local connection because I was thinking these things when I was working at Prairie Sun up in Cotati, a recording studio there, recording O.J. Ekemode, a great Nigerian singer and songwriter. And I had an opportunity around that time to sit in on some classes at Stanford University down in Palo Alto about the brain. And I just kept sitting in on classes and kept learning more. And it wasn't really a sudden decision. It was more gradual. At some point, I just found myself enjoying the classes and taking more and more. And I finally decided I might as well get a bachelor's degree in it and see where things go.
That's really fun. It's neat to have, you know, multiple careers having, you know, spanned a period of time that feed into each other, but are, and can influence each other as well. So, I'm wondering also about the brain and human behavior. Is music, from what you've seen, is music inherent to the human brain and human behavior? Are there any cultures that have no music of any describable kind?
It's an interesting question about what's inherent in the brain and what isn't. I don't know that I could argue that music or language, either one is inherent, but there's a lot of evidence that suggests they are, but certainly what we can say with certainty is that the brain contains circuits, specialized circuits for processing language and music. And they do so from a very young age, and there is no culture that we know of now or at any time in the past that has lacked music or language for that matter. So music and language both seem to be an intrinsic part of humanity for as long as we've been able to tell. And they activate some shared neural structures as well as some distinct neural structures.
Yeah. In terms of language, I know that there are a couple of different ideas about how language, about how languages, how they work, whether there are intrinsic rules to human language. And there are some examples maybe from South American jungles that suggest that there might not be a generalization to language. Do you think that there is a generalization to music in the brain?
It's hard to say. There are some regularities across culture and across time. But those may not be brain-based. They really may be physics-based. So, for example, every musical culture and every music has the octave. That's a special relationship between tones that vibrate at either twice or half the frequency of one another. In our musical system, we have this do-re-mi system where the notes get the same name every time there's a doubling or a halving of frequency. So we have do-re-mi-fa-sol-la-ti. Do. We repeat the name because the notes seem to have something perceptually in common. And that falls out of physics more than it does out of brains, I think. And yet, the brain has special modes of processing when it encounters the octave.
Yeah, so does the brain respond in a fairly stereotypical way to a particular note or a harmonic of that note?
The interesting thing is that neurons will fire in synchrony with the firing rate in synchrony with the frequency of the tone. Mm-hmm. And the brain recognizes octaves to such a degree that if you take a complex tone, a system of harmonic partials, such as might be found on a piano, and you remove the lowest one, the brain actually fills it in as though it's expecting it to be there, even when it's not.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most fascinating aspects of the brain. There's a lot of filling in the gaps. The brain does the visual cortex, the auditory cortex. It's also with hallucinations, other things. It's the brain kind of making stuff up and saying, this should be here.
You're absolutely right. And the emerging picture, especially in the last 30 years, is that we're a lot less conscious of what's really going on than we think we are. And
right.
The brain is making a lot more inferences than we realize.
Yeah. Have you looked much at the idea of musical exposure and brain development and what we know through current scientific research about, how much listening to music or making music affects development of the brain?
It does appear that there is a critical period for acquiring musical cognition, similar to the critical period there is for acquiring language. So we now know from studies of feral children or children who have been locked in attics, unfortunately, things like this, that if you don't get any exposure to spoken language age of 10 or 12, you'll never be able to speak fluently. And this is paralleled in music. If you don't have exposure to music in the first decade or so of life, it's very unlikely that you'll come to appreciate listening or that you'll be able to really play any kind of music. And the reason is that during that first decade of life, the brain is wiring itself up to the inputs that it receives. Without musical input or linguistic input, there isn't any pathway that the brain can use to make sense of it.
So once again, it's kind of bringing the language and the music, these two things that society does to communicate ideas very often, kind of bringing them together, that music, is music an extension of language in that sense then?
Or is language an extension of music?
Right, yeah.
We don't know which came first. There's evidence on both sides. They're certainly very closely related. And I think what we can say with some certainty is that they serve different functions for us. So language is typically, although not always, about things that we can refer to, concrete things. And music is non-referential. It doesn't refer to specific objects. I mean, obviously, a musical piece like The Swan, right, refers to a particular animal. But there's nothing intrinsic in the music that's swan-like. It's the composer, it's Sasson's striving to encapsulate the feelings of a swan in music. But if you didn't know it was named the swan, it would be hard to figure that out. Music is non-referential. Language is referential. Music is more facile for communicating emotion than language is at times. I'm sure we've all had the experience that we weren't able to put into words how we were feeling, and then the right song comes on, and you go, oh, yeah, that's it. That's how I feel.
Right.
The music is able to capture it.
And hence why soundtracks are so important to movies.
Absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up, because a Canadian colleague of mine, Annabelle Cohen, and another colleague in the United States, Marilyn Boltz, had separately done some important work on film soundtracks. And one of the studies that I like best is where they took a neutral scene, a woman walking through nature and a man following her, and they added two different kinds of music. Mm-hmm. So when they show the scene without any music at all, and they ask people what's going on, people, you know, say, well, there's this man and he's following this woman. And it's there's no particular emotional content. When you add romantic music, people believe that she knows she's being pursued and she's playing hard to get. If you add kind of, you know, Hitchcock psycho music, like, you know, kind of horror soundtrack, then it seems like he's an attacker. And it's the music that's able to disambiguate an otherwise ambiguous scene.
I love that. I think it's just fascinating. Well, I know that you have very limited time this evening, and I'm unfortunately not going to be able to make it to the Commonwealth Club tonight at 7:30 for your discussion and presentation. But as you told me before the show, the broadcast, because it is with the Commonwealth Club, will be recorded and broadcast on public radio at some point in the future. So people might be able to catch it, which is very exciting, I think, for everyone who might have gotten a little taste of what you work on and what you've written about in your books.
Thank you for having me on the show.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for joining me, and have a wonderful evening. I hope everything is as fun as you expect it to be.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. That was Daniel Levitin. He is the author of This Is Your Brain on Music, The Science of a Human Obsession, and The World in Six Songs, How the Musical Brain Created Human Nature. And as I do the interview, I can't help but think about how the brain develops in response to music or in conjunction to music, as I listen to my child, Kai, being very loud in the other room. So I hope that you are enjoying that as well. Sometimes, you know, kids are just a little louder than you want them to be. But, you know, in those moments, there's always Netflix. Turn on the TV, right? Babysit your kid? No, don't do that. But maybe enjoy a movie or a television show with your child every once in a while. This hour of Dr. Kiki Science Hour is brought to you by Netflix. Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you instantly, which means you save time, money, and hassle. There are several easy ways to instantly access streaming movies and TV shows with Netflix. First, you can watch Netflix movies and TV shows on your Mac, PC, iPad, iPhone, some Android devices. If you have a gaming console like an Xbox or a PS3 or a Nintendo Wii, you can watch Netflix right on your TV. And if you have you're not a gamer, but you have an Apple TV or a Roku box, you can use those set-top boxes to be able to easily and fairly inexpensively get access to Netflix. With Netflix, you can watch movies and TV shows instantly using any of these devices, and you can watch starting on one device and then finish it up on any other device. It doesn't make you start over and have to find your spot. Netflix remembers where you left off. Whichever way you choose to access Netflix, you can watch as many movies and TV shows as you want, anytime you want, and you can cancel at any time. Try Netflix today for 30 days for absolutely free. Go to netflix.com/twit. That's right. Be sure to use this URL when you sign up for your free trial, Netflix, netflix.com/twit. We thank Netflix for their support of Twit and Dr. Kiki Science Hour, and we hope you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix. And now it's time for our second guest of the show, Dr. Diana Rice. And according to Wikipedia, Dr. Rice is a professor of psychology at Hunter College and in the graduate program of biopsychology and behavioral neuroscience of the City of New York, City University of New York, SUNY. Rice's work on understanding cognition and communication in dolphins and other cetaceans has also done work in mirror self-recognition in these animals and elephants. She was the scientific advisor for the Cove, if any of you out there have seen that, and she earned a doctorate from Temple University. Dr. Rice, thank you so much for joining me today.
Have the chance to talk to you this way.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
You're hearing me fine?
I am hearing you just fine now, yes. Great. It's good. Hopefully everything will stay for the duration of the show so that we can have a nice interview.
Super.
But, you know, we understand technical issues. We deal with them all the time here.
I'm actually dealing with technical issues with animals when we're working with equipment, so this is fun.
Exactly. We're all still animals, just, you know, maybe with opposable thumbs.
Right. Okay.
Dr. Rice, tell me a bit about how you got into working with cetaceans. What got you interested in animal behavior and specifically dolphins and other mammals of the sea?
Yes, well, I was really interested in trying to understand the intelligence of other animals in general. I was fascinated by how communication develops as well. When I was a graduate student at Temple University, I wasn't sure initially I was interested in dolphins. In fact, I was never a dolphin fan. I never watched Flipper or anything like that. And I remember I got interested in dolphins when I actually read about whaling. And I read an article in the New York Times about whaling, and I thought, oh, we hardly know anything about these incredible animals. And I started reading everything I could. I got particularly interested in dolphins just because there had been some bit written about them. There had been some information about the brains of dolphins. They were large, they were complex. But we were just learning about the sociality of the dolphins. We know that now that they're quite complex. And it really just fascinated me because we knew so little. So that's the area I decided to study.
Since you started, do you think that we've how far do you think that we've come in our understanding of their brains? Has it been leaps and bounds, or are we still really just picking at the surface?
Yeah, well, brains is we're talking about brain. Are we talking about brains, or are we talking about intelligence? I think they're very different things. One it can inform the other. I think there have been many studies of dolphin brains, and we're learning more about the anatomy, neuroanatomy of their brains. The facts we know that they have larger neurons, so do elephants, than primate brains, and those of many others. And we know that their brains are organized differently than our human brains or brains of many other animals. But it's the behavior that I've been focusing on and their cognitive abilities. And I think we're still in the infancy of those studies. I think we're just, you know, seeing the tip of the iceberg, so to speak. But having said that, I think we've learned that they are very intelligent. And it gets into the question of, well, what do we mean by intelligence in dolphins? I think that's the question that's so provocative.
Yeah. So in your opinion, what do we mean by intelligence in dolphins?
Yeah. I think when we think about intelligence, we have to think of that species relative to the environment and the social environment in which those animals have evolved. And, you know, dolphins are intelligent in ways that we're not. They deal with things in their environment in ways that we couldn't just based on our physiology. But when we talk about intelligence, to me, a good definition has been put forth by someone named Ross Ashby. He talks about the power of appropriate selection, whether it's in humans, other animals, or machines. You know, how are these mammals reacting to certain circumstances that they have to confront? And in my interactions with dolphins, both in aquaria, where I've done most of my studies, as well as in the wild, which I'm doing some of the studies now, I think that we're seeing they show great flexibility, they show great memory, and they show a capacity for what I call self-organization, how they organize information that they're getting. And I think in some ways they do it in strikingly similar ways to the way we do it, and that's quite remarkable.
So in terms of, yeah, in terms of organizing information, so are you talking that they are individuals gather from the environment? Are you talking about social organization and the way that they work one another?
Yeah, I'm talking about both. So let me address. I'll give you one example. So several years ago, one of the students I worked with at my lab and I did a study. Dr. Brenda McCowan and I did a study together, looking at what would happen if we gave dolphins an underwater keyboard. Now, this may seem odd, giving a dolphin a keyboard when they don't have hands. You know, we can see working with keyboards with primates, but dolphins. But I was really interested in what would happen if we gave dolphins these really complex, big-brained mammals more choice and control. I was interested in their vocal learning abilities, how they would learn. I wanted to see not only how they would learn, but what they would learn. So I designed an underwater keyboard system, and if they hit a key on a keyboard, there were 9 keys, and they had different visual symbols on them. If they hit a key, let's say a triangle, that appeared in the upper left-hand corner, they would hear a whistle that was generated by the computer. And that whistle was within their own time and frequency range of signals they could produce themselves, but different in the type of whistle it was. And when they hit a key, they would hear a whistle like, and they would get a ball. If they had a different shaped key, they would hear a different whistle form, like, and get a rub. A different symbol would result in them getting a ring. We picked things that we thought would be reinforcing to the dolphins. Now, all the dolphins had to do was use this as a vending machine. They just had to hit a key, and they would get an object. They had to remember which visual form would get them specific objects because they were randomized. Their positions on the keyboard were randomized once every minute. Well, the dolphins used it actively, but they did much more. And what they did was they started to imitate the signals, the whistles they were hearing very quickly. When I say quickly, after the 19th time, and then the next whistle was after the 9th time, and the next whistle was after, you know, the first time. But they did more. So they would hit a key, they would hear, and they'd get a ball. Now, in that same session, they started to play with the ball and whistle the ball sound as they were playing with the ball. Then they would go back up to the keyboard, and at times they would whistle the ball key and then hit the ball. They would whistle the ball whistle and then hit the correct key. So this was quite fascinating because we didn't know what we were going to get. We sort of put it in the dolphins, I can't say in the dolphins' hands because they're non-handed, but we gave them, again, control of the system. And what we saw was that they were acquiring these signals in ways that we see young children acquire their first signals. Because not only were they imitating the sounds, but they were actually showing segmentation. When they first repeated the ball whistle, they only repeated the very end. Then the next time they did it, they just repeated the beginning, and then they put it all together with harmonics. And again, that's, you know, we're talking about them showing the recency and primacy effect. I mean, it was fascinating. It was the first time we had seen the process of vocal learning in these animals. And what was interesting is that these were with 2 dolphins where we knew their history because they were born in our facility. They were 11 months old when we started working with them. They were with their mothers. And so we had been recording their own vocal development and had published on this as well. So we could really watch how a young system self-organizes. And it was in many ways they were doing things that was quite reminiscent of what we see our own species doing when they're acquiring.
I think that's fascinating.
What was really remarkable that is in other studies. I know my colleague Lou Herman, who and his students had done fascinating work at University of Hawaii looking at cognitive abilities of dolphins. They had taken a very different approach years before that to look at vocal learning in dolphins and mimicry. We knew dolphins mimicked. We suspect that that's how they learned their own signals, but nobody had actually done a specific study. They trained dolphins to imitate specific parameters of the signals that they were playing to them. So they first trained them using food reinforcement to imitate the duration of a signal, and that took several hundred trials. Then once they could do that, they imitated, they trained them to imitate the frequency modulation or the change from one pitch to another of a signal. And that took an additional 100 trials. So it took these dolphins, when you selected, when the researchers selected the parameters, it took many more trials. And it may have been the dolphins didn't know what was being asked. I think if you give dolphins the ability to show us what they can do and give them something they can manipulate on their own, it's a very different way of learning about their cognitive abilities. And that's sort of my MO when I work with dolphins.
Yeah, so it's taking an ethological approach to it. So taking the abilities of the dolphins into account and trying to get to allow them to shape project more than the, I guess, researcher defining everything. That's always been a question of mine having to do with animal behaviors. You know, how much are you really learning about animal behavior when the researchers are telling the animals what to do?
Yeah. And again, we can learn lots of things by asking whether a dolphin or an elephant or a chimpanzee can see, you know, the difference between this shape and that shape or these distinctions. And often we, you know, we have to ask questions in certain ways, but there's a whole other line of questioning that I think is just so rich. And I actually really like to work that way. I work with them as partners as much as I can in designing the experiments. And it's actually so gratifying because it's almost like stepping out of their way.
As the researcher, get out of their way so the dolphins can give you the information that you can use.
Yes. Another example is some of the work that we've done with mirror self-recognition. Now, you know, it's quite fascinating because the mirror is a simple tool. It's just a surface. And it's something that contains potential information, and we can ask, how do other animals interpret that information? Many animals, you know, we were exploring mirror self-recognition as an index of a level of self-awareness or consciousness. This is a level we used to think was uniquely human until Gordon Gallup showed it in our closest relative, the relatives, the chimpanzees, and then later in all the great apes. And you know, with dolphins, they were sort of parvenus in this area. We didn't think other species could do it because most animals either don't pay attention to that, what they see in the reflection, or if they do, they react as if it's a conspecific. You know, if it's one of their kind and show social behaviors. My colleague Laurie Marie and I decided to look at dolphins, and it was fascinating what we found.
Yeah, so in the bird research that I've done working with lots of species of birds, you show, say, a mountain chickadee a mirror, and that mountain chickadee, if it's a male, will start attacking the mirror because it thinks it's a conspecific male that is invading its territory. How do you set up the mirror self-recognition studies so that you can, you know, tell the difference between a conspecific response, a self-awareness response? You know, what are you looking for, and how do you set that up?
Yeah, so generally, let me just set the whole study up for people who may not be familiar with this. So in Gordon Gallup's original research, I'm going to put my glasses on because my screen, I'm not seeing well. Better feedback, pardon my glasses. So when Gordon Gallup did the original studies, and he really pioneered this work with the great apes, as we were talking about, what he did was he exposed chimpanzees to the mirror. What they first showed, if they were mirror naive, was exploratory and social behavior. They basically show three stages. So you first get exploratory, where the chimpanzee might try to look behind the mirror, over the mirror, to check, is there somebody back there? What is this thing? You know, the responding to the novelty of it. Then they generally show social behaviors you see directed towards another of your own kind, a conspecific. So it might be aggression, it might be more affiliative, but you have to really be pretty familiar, very familiar, I should say, with the species you're studying, because you have to know what social behavior is. So that's a requirement. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then after you see this first stage, For animals that go on to show mirror self-recognition, the second stage emerges. And this is the stage that we call contingency testing. And if anybody's seen the classic Groucho Marx skit in front of the mirror or the Harpo Marx Lucille Ball skit, you know, where they're moving back and forth and they're sort of moving their hands back and forth, it's characterized by highly repetitive and really unusual behaviors in front of a mirror. And this seems to be a period where the dolphin or the human or the chimpanzee is somehow seeing that there's a relationship or testing the relationship between what it does and what it sees in the mirror. And they're learning that there is indeed a one-to-one correspondence between their movement and what they're seeing in the mirror. So the one in the mirror has to have some sense, some proprioceptive sense, right? Proprioceptive sense of knowing where how one's body is moving, where your hand is in relationship to your body. You need to have that to be able to understand that you're seeing the same thing reflected in front of you. So that's a critical, that's when the light bulb kind of goes on, when they figure it out. And again, in species that go on to show mirror self-recognition, this seems to be a critical stage. Then that's followed.
I was going to ask just briefly in terms of humans, you know, at what point humans start showing that in development?
Yeah, you generally see mirror self-recognition and the precursors starting at about 18 months and to 24 months of age in children. And in chimpanzees, there have been some outliers. I mean, it's been reported that a 10-month-old can show mirror self-directed behavior as well. But generally, it's been about between 18 and 24 months when there are all these connections being made in the brain. It's when children start showing empathic responding to those around them. It's not so much me centered as they may see their mom or their dad or a sibling with a boo-boo getting hurt, and they may start paying attention to that and showing concern, sense of understanding what it's like to be in another's place. So empathy and mere self-recognition seem to emerge just about the same time when there's this cognitive sort of jump. And that's interesting in and of itself. And Gordon Gallup had been the first to really point this out. I want to give Gordon full credit for all of that. So anyway, but going back to these stages, and then there's this third stage that emerges that we call self-directed behaviors, where whether you're a human or a chimpanzee or a dolphin or an elephant, you start looking at yourself. You're using the mirror as a tool to self-view. And that's really fascinating. So you see these three stages emerge, and it's often very difficult to discern. Once you start seeing self-directed behavior, you may still see these repetitive movements because they may still be testing or looking at themselves doing different things, much like, you know, teenagers or any of us check ourselves out in the mirror to see what we look like when we're doing that new dance step, you know, how goofy we really look. You know, we watch ourselves doing things in the mirror. How do I look in this dress? You know, what do I look like when I move a certain way? I mean, we certainly use mirrors to check out what we're doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there are these markers, but you really do have to be very familiar with the animal you're studying, or it would be very difficult to discern what was going on. I'll just tell you something quite interesting. Many years ago, I was asked to review a paper that had been submitted on where someone was claiming that very small squid were showing mirror self-directed behavior. Or self-recognition, and it was never published because what I explained was what the squid were doing was they were showing social behavior. You know, they were clearly showing social behavior. Squid will put out one of their tentacles to when they greet other squid, and that's just what they were doing to the mirror. So you really have to know your subjects that you're studying, and that is critical. Yeah. So what we found what I found so remarkable, and I've been so lucky to have great colleagues to work with and be able to do studies with both dolphins and elephants. We did the dolphin study and published it in the National Academy of Sciences in 2001. And then with my colleagues Franz Duval and Josh Plotnick at Emory University, we did another study that was published again with elephants showing mirror self-recognition. And that was published again in the National Academy of Sciences in 2006. So what we found were strikingly similar, not only these stages were similar across chimps, humans, dolphins, and elephants, but that even the behaviors that they exhibited, the self-directed behaviors, were similar It's amazing. It's these strikingly similar behaviors. So, for example, it seems like we all like to look at our eyes closely, up close, which is curious. We like to look at what's the insides of our mouths. Dolphins and elephants were looking at the insides of their mouths. They look at parts of their bodies they can't see. Dolphins like to look at their genitals. So do human children. You know, so we share this curiosity about certain parts of our body, and I just find that wonderful.
Yeah, it's really interesting that there is such a similarity across the animal kingdom, that these, you know, all mammals, but still, you know, these disparate species that are following this pattern.
So, of course, we talk about that as cognitive convergence. We talked about that initially with the dolphins. Mm. And what was so interesting about the dolphins in many ways is that for many years it had been considered that it had been thought about that our closest relatives, the great apes, were doing this processing with the frontal lobes. You know, that when you have damaged frontal lobe, that you'll have a decrement in this kind of processing. People may lose the ability for mere self-recognition and along with other aspects of cognitive processing. And with the dolphins, their brains are organized differently than are those of great apes and humans. They have big, complex brains packed with neurons. And as I said, the neurons are larger than our neurons, but they're not as densely packed. And that may really represent just a different kind of scaling, you know, of brains or organization of brains. But, you know, there's not a clearly demarcated frontal lobe region like in our brains where you can say, this is the frontal lobe. So it may be more distributed. It may be different. And that's what's so fascinating, that, you know, here's a different brain, but coming up with the same solutions, being able to process information and arriving at mere self-recognition and showing similarities. And that's when we talked about this issue of cognitive convergence. I mean, they couldn't be more different than us in body form. We've been separated for 95 billion years of evolution, yet here we are showing such strikingly similar patterns of behavior, even though our brains are different.
Yeah. Is there looking across the cetacean brains, is there any areas that seem to, that appear to be picking up that frontal lobe responsibility? I know that, the avian brain is structured differently, yet at the same time as there's a hippocampus in the human brain, there's a region that we call the hippocampus in the avian brain that works with spatial learning and memory. Is there something that you can find similarly in the dolphin brain, or have those studies not yet been done?
They haven't been done yet, and of course those are such provocative questions. You know, it's incredible what we're finding about bird brains. It's very hard to do that kind of imaging on a dolphin, and we certainly don't want to sacrifice dolphins. You know, we're not going to do that kind of invasive work. So, you know, when we get, I mean, I think I think one study that was done with brain imaging with a dolphin. It was done very carefully by some colleagues, and they were looking at vocal production, or I think it was for echolocation production. Mm-hmm. But I don't think we're very close to that yet. Maybe we'll be surprised, and there'll be better, some equipment that's more portable, and we would be able to do some of those studies. But again, these are animals that are quite sensitive. They get stressed very easily. I think we have to be extremely careful about working with them.
Yeah. So in terms of the working with these animals and doing this self-awareness research, cognition research, you know, you mentioned that one of the pitfalls is jumping to conclusions because you're not familiar enough with the species. Are there any other examples of pitfalls of working with animals like dolphins in your research?
I do think there are. I'll give you an example with the elephants, and I know we may be doing another session with my doctoral student, Preston Furter, later about, just published a study in PLOS One looking at elephant cognition. And we were very interested in trying to understand more about the intelligence of elephants. There have been a number of studies done, but we're in the infancy of this field as well. So we had done this mirror self-recognition study, and a paper came out several years ago suggesting that elephants don't show evidence for insightful problem solving. And what's meant by insightful problem solving, and again, there's some controversy whether there is insightful problem solving is distinct from other kinds of problem solving, but let's just go with that term for the moment. The idea that humans and other animals can come up with a sudden solution to a problem without prior trial and error. Okay? And, you know, Thorpe had discussed this. Wolfgang Kirler did the first study showing chimpanzees could solve a problem suddenly and figure out how to get bananas that were hung high above their heads. How would they get that? There were boxes near them, there were sticks, but they couldn't reach these bananas. And they figured out a way to do it, stacking boxes and clambering up on the boxes and getting these bananas. Anyway, so there had been a paper that came out several years ago suggesting that elephants didn't show this kind of insightful problem solving. And it was really based on just a few studies, a couple of which hadn't been published because they got negative results. And there was a speculation that dolphins might have a savant-type brain. In other words, they might be good at spatial memory, but not at this kind of problem solving. And it had been suggested that it could be because the neurons in their brain were more separated, were more distant than those neurons in human brains and primate brains and those of many other animals. And as I said before, elephants may be showing a different kind of organization in their brain, a different kind of scaling. They have larger neurons, as do dolphins and whales, and they are more distantly separated. Yet, you know, that doesn't mean that it's better or worse. I mean, when you think about neurons being larger, that gives you more surface structure for more connections. So, again, we're still in the infancy of understanding this. But it was a conclusion that had been jumped to, that they might have a savant brain because of this, this, and this, based on very few studies and very limited studies. And that really, you know, for us was fortunate because it spurred us on to saying, well, let's do another study and really test this out. But I do think often we base a lot of our conclusions on a lack of evidence rather than the wrong evidence, you know, showing that animals can't do things. We simply haven't looked enough. Ways that are relevant for these animals. I think we have to try to put ourselves in an elephant's place or a dolphin's place as much as possible and help that them help us design things perhaps more from their point of view. It's easy to say. Yeah, it's not easy to do.
It's not. Absolutely. And with dolphins particularly, you're looking at an animal whose home is in the oceans, and the dolphins that we can study are either in captivity, which the numbers are limited, or you have to know about certain dolphin hangouts. You have to know where you can find the dolphins to be able to come in contact with them in the wild to be able to do the studies. And once again, those populations are probably very limited as well.
Yes, and then again, it gets into the ethics of doing something disruptive in the wild to dolphins. You know, you have to get permits. So we do field studies now in Bimini and Belize, where other studies have been going on, and I'm trying to go into the wild to ask specific questions by watching them from afar, where we'll go in, but we try to be very respectful about going in with our camera equipment and our hydrophones, which are underwater microphones, and we'll observe them, but we don't touch them, we don't try to get them to do anything. I don't want to be very disruptive with the animals out there. And frankly, I'm a little hesitant to do anything like we would do with a keyboard out in the wild because I don't want to introduce sounds to them in the wild, because if we want to study their natural systems of communication in the wild, we don't know what we're doing. You know, we don't know how it might. I just find that we maybe should be leaving the dolphins in the wild alone in terms of putting anything acoustic in there, that we're trying to teach them something in the wild. I think the dolphins in aquariums are exactly those dolphins that we should be working with and trying to give them very rich and environments and giving them choice and control. I mean, I think we should be doing much more with the dolphins that are in aquariums to learn as much as we can from those animals. I really feel strongly about that. And I think that we need a lot more protection for dolphins, and whatever we can learn from the ones that are in captivity is critical. And I think that we need to protect the ones in the wild and the ones in aquaria so they have the best possible lives.
And do you think, I mean, you made the comment that providing them with more rich stimuli. So by doing studies, do you think you can actually improve the environments that they're in the aquaria, that you can actually give them a more naturalistic experience?
No, I think saying it's naturalistic, it's not a naturalistic environment. And yeah. I think we have to be real about that. However, there are dolphins that are in aquaria that were born there. Most dolphins now, well, most aquaria in the United States, to my knowledge, haven't taken dolphins for 20 years from the wild. And I hope that continues. I feel very strongly as a scientist that we should not be removing any dolphins or whales from the wild, and we need global protection for them. So we have to be very, we really have to get on and really work hard for global protection. It's what I do now. I've really stepped into an advocacy role as well. And I think we have to have our science-informing policy. Having said that, I think that we have to take another look at what's going on in aquaria. And I think there are good aquaria and bad aquariums. And I think there are many aquariums that can be doing a lot more than they're doing, not just in terms of the conservation messages, but the animal welfare messaging. And I think that they also should be thinking about giving dolphins much more choice and control and making social groups as rich as possible, in for the animals that are there. I mean, these animals have strong, long-lived bonds. They develop friendships, alliances. We know that from the wild. And I think we have to start modeling more what we're doing with dolphins in aquaria and maintaining those bonds. Many aquariums do that, but not all of them do that. And certainly aquariums outside of this country actually are continuing to take dolphins from the wild. And some aquariums are taking dolphins from the dolphin drives we saw in the Cove, which is really an abomination.
Wow.
So I'm putting my advocacy hat on now. You can hear this.
Yeah, I can hear it. You have so much passion in your voice.
Well, I working this closely with dolphins, and again, I consider them my mentors as well. I mean, I can be an objective scientist about this, but at the same time, I'm taking what I've learned and saying quite emphatically, these are really big brains. These are really highly social species. We need to protect them. We know enough to protect them now. We know enough that they should not be being slaughtered. And the slaughter is so inhumane on top of it. I mean, it would be bad enough that they would be euthanized if an animal's ill. To be euthanized, it should be done in a way that's humane. And what's going on in the dolphin drives is not only inhumane, but it's so inhumane that it's hard to believe it's continuing. I mean, I watch videos that are coming in now, the past months, and it's gotten worse than it was, when it was even depicted in the Cove. I mean, they're essentially pithing the animals, if you can believe this. It's similar to what's going on.
Wow.
Remember, you could.
I had to pith frogs for a physiology lab at university. So, yeah,
you cannot pith. You're not. I mean, if you're in a laboratory, your pithing is not considered humane for mammals.
No.
Small. And I'm not sure if it's still allowed in frogs, in amphibians or not. But what's happening in the wild, what we've been seeing is, they're putting steel rods, they're hammering steel rods behind the blowhole of dolphins. And these are fishermen. These are not people who know what they're doing. And then they're actually plugging the hole with a wooden dowel to keep the blood from pouring into the water. I mean, it's just... it's something out of Dante's Inferno. So as a scientist, I feel that we have to get other scientists to speak out about this.
Do you think, I've like last year, or gosh, now was it maybe a couple of years ago, at the AAAS annual meeting, there was a push, and I don't know if you were part of this, to start actually... what was that?
I was... one of the speakers.
You're one of the speakers. Okay. I believe I actually came to the session, to to actually give dolphins a humane treatment status, or to actually put them on a conscious animal list, to give them to make sure that around the globe they get better treatment. Do you think that the self-awareness research that you've done, that the science supports this view?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, it's very interesting. So this was the AAAS meeting. It was the annual meeting. It was a session on dolphin intelligence and ethical and political considerations. And there were four of us speaking, and I spoke about the dolphin drive and applying our science to global policy. So that was actually what I had been talking about. And I think we have ample evidence from dolphins, from what we know about their social behavior, from longitudinal studies in the wild that have been done by several different research groups, showing that they show social complexity that rivals now or exceeds that of chimpanzee societies, where they have alliances and super alliances and, you know, just are highly cooperative, to levels of awareness that where they actually show empathic behavior for others and show this mere self-recognition. I mean, these are animals that are aware of self. These are animals that are highly susceptible to ulcers and stress, as are some other mammals that we know, like the great apes. And us, our humans. And I think that they're very sensitive to pain. And, you know, I think given all these things, they do need protection. I think they need global protection. Now, we protect them in our waters. If a marine mammal strands off the coast of New Jersey or off the California coast, you have to have special groups that are trained to be able to even go near those dolphins. They're protected. And, you know, you think about that, and you think about the care that goes into trying to get these animals healthy and back into the ocean. And then you look at the fact that the way they're being mistreated in other places of the world. And we've got to get our science informing policy. I mean, scientific fact we don't have scientific facts in one country and not other countries. Scientific facts need to transcend cultural and geographic boundaries. I talked about this at the AAAS meeting. So what we know about these dolphins should transcend and be applied in other countries like Japan and other countries as well. But it's not. And I do think that we have to find some way of changing this.
It's called making a global ruling body that consists of scientists. No.
Right. And, you know, if only. You know, and I do think that scientists really need to become advocates. And this doesn't mean you're less of a scientist. You know, when I was younger, I was always told, don't speak out, don't get into a political arena, don't get into advocacy situations because you'll lose your credibility. Yeah. And now I feel like I've spent the good portion of my academic career, you know, working on scientific papers, you know, trying to be conservative in the way I interpret my data. But then you learn about these animals and you say, okay, given our knowledge, our current state of knowledge and what we're learning in all the labs, and what do we know about the physiology, the biology, the neuroanatomy, the behavior, these animals need protection. I think it's clear. And what I'm thrilled about is so many of my colleagues are agreeing. They've stepped out and they've signed what we call the scientist statement. A few of us put together a scientist petition that said these animals need protection. And we did this several years ago, and 300 of the world's leading marine mammalogists have signed on to this. And again, we could get many more names. I'm sure we had a particular few days that we had this petition open, and we're going to continue working in this direction. But I do think we need scientists speaking about what they know. If they're not speaking out, who will?
Right. Yeah, who are the advocates going to be, and what are they going to be able to say if they aren't informed by the science, by the research?
And I think the other thing I just want to mention here is this is not an emotional response. I mean, we're looking at scientific fact, we're looking at data, we look at what these animals are about, and we're saying, given this is the logical thing to do. Of course, it's painful emotionally to watch footage of these incredible animals, these beautiful minds being slaughtered. And again, it's hard to be a human being and watch that and not be emotionally riveted. I mean, people who saw the Cove said it changed their lives after they saw this film. They wanted to do something. But from a purely logical point of view, and then drawing ethics from science and logic, I mean, it's not only the scientific thing correct thing to do, but it's the ethical thing to do as well, based on our knowledge.
Right. So talking about telling the things that you know, you've written a book, The Dolphin in the Mirror. Can you tell us a bit about what you've written in the book and what you're trying to do by publishing?
Yes, and I really wanted to get this book written this year because I wanted to share a lot of the experiences I had working with dolphins, getting to know them individually from years of work together. And I talk about the different studies I've done from trying to record their own signals and decipher or decode how they communicate. And again, I talk a little bit about some of that work, particularly the work with the underwater keyboards, which I've just mentioned. And they're just remarkable things we've learned and we've watched dolphins do that are, you know, as part of this systematic study that went on for 2 years at my laboratory. And dolphins doing much more than we would have necessarily predicted. And then I talk about the mirror studies that we've done as well. And then I also talk a little bit about the mythology of dolphins and the history of how people have thought about dolphins. And then I get into animal cognition in general. I talk a little bit about the history of how we've thought about our relationship with other animals in terms of thinking. For a long time, we thought we were the only species that were thinking creatures. And, you know, the question was, well, do other animals think? The whole question's changed now. As you know, not to do they think, but how do they think? You know, if you're a magpie, what is the nature of their intelligence? So, and they're just wonderful studies that are coming out. And every day I get excited when I look at, you know, I open another journal and I see a new article about one species or another. And it's just fascinating that the closer we look, the more we're learning. It's just, this world is rich with minded creatures, you know, showing intelligent behavior, problem-solving behaviors, communicative behaviors, referential or semantic kinds of communication. Who would have thought that vervet monkeys, you know, the classic study by Seyfarth, Cheney, and Marler, vervet monkeys are not just responding emotionally to things in their environment. They have what have been termed semantic signals for predators in their environment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, seeing this with other species as well. We thought animals were emotive, but they seem to also share other kinds of communication signals. But again, we have to be extremely careful not to overinterpret our data, and I think scientists are working generally very carefully to make sure they're not overinterpreting. So when I did the keyboard study, we saw behavior that looked a lot like the way young children acquire their first words. But I never called it language. I just said they learned what appeared to be close associations between the visual keys on the keyboard, the sounds they were learning, and these objects. But I didn't feel like I had enough data to say they were functioning as symbolically or they were functioning as words, even though the dolphins started using them between each other at the very end of the study. I didn't feel like I had enough data to say that. So that's a study that we're hoping to get funded in the near future to do a much higher tech kind of keyboard with dolphins so we can go on and look at how vocal culture emerges in groups of dolphins when you give them new signals, choice and control, and they can use a keyboard that's a higher tech kind of device.
That'll be fascinating to find out about those results and to hear, you know, do dolphins, how does their language develop? Is it a similar learning pattern to, say, the parrots, Pepperberg work that's done? Is it, you know, is it similar to human children? What kind of structure do they have is it symbolic? You know, what kind of structure to their language? Is there anything we can learn about that?
That's right. And Irene Pepperberg's actually one of the people who's going to be involved in this study. Another person Oprah Chernikovsky, who's here with us at Hunter College now as well. And he and I are collaborating on this same study. And he just does incredibly fascinating work on how vocal culture emerges in zebra finch. Right. And I'm hoping to apply some of those techniques as well. So it's great. It's really wonderful when you can have these interdisciplinary, interspecies kinds of collaborations with people from the, you know, who've been studying birds. And one of my other colleagues, Sonia Regeer, who studies development of play behavior in primates, and she's on the study as well. So I'm very excited about this potential research.
It sounds really exciting. So I don't want to keep you much longer. I know that we are at the end of the show, and I know that you've also been fighting a cold similar to myself.
Yeah, I hope I didn't sound too worse. I'm sort of feeling like it's getting worse and worse, but it was just wonderful talking with you.
It was great talking to you, and I'm glad that we were able to get this interview together and be able to have this discussion. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on. Take care.
You're welcome. Bye. Take you. Thank you. You Bye. Take care as well. And anyone who is interested, you can find her book. It is out now. It is published by...
Houghton Mifflin Harcourt Books.
And you can find it online or probably in requested from what remaining bookstores there are terrestrially. As well. And it's called The Dolphin in the Mirror. Exactly. Okay. So anyone looking for that? The Dolphin in the Mirror is the book to look for. Many thanks to Diana Rice and Daniel Levitin also for joining us here on Dr. Kiki Science Hour today. And for all the information about animal behavior, brains, music, human behavior. You can search for both of their books online. I am Dr. Kiki, and this has been the Dr. Kiki Science Hour. Next week, we're going to be talking about experimental philosophy with Joshua Knobe. And Joshua Knobe actually has an effect named after him, an experimental effect. It's the side effect, otherwise known as the Knobe effect. But we will be talking with him next week. And until then, you can follow my sciencey pursuits on Twitter. I'm Dr. Kiki, D-R-K-I-K-I. You can find me on my Facebook fan page, Dr. Kiki. You can Google Plus me, Kiki Sanford. And you can subscribe to Dr. Kiki Science Hour in iTunes or find past episodes at twit.tv/Kiki. And if you need to contact me in the next... I don't know, week or so, some period of time, you can go through these social networks or you can send me an email at drkiki@drkiki.tv. I'll be back next week. I'm looking forward to seeing you once again. Those of you in the chat room, thanks for the conversation in there. At one point, your comments actually, I almost spit tea through my nose. Comments were pretty funny today. And thanks for tuning into the Science Hour. All I ask is 1 hour per week. Remember, 1 hour a week makes your world a whole lot more interesting. And now for your science meditation of the week.
In northeast India, a giant cliff leads up into a hidden world. Meghalaya. Nearly 2 kilometers high and buffeted by monsoon storm clouds, this is possibly the wettest place on Earth. Once, 25 meters of rain fell here in a year, the world record. Living here poses an unusual problem, and it's not just keeping dry. Nearly all the rain falls during the summer monsoon. Rivers switch from gentle streams to raging torrents. They become wild and unpredictable, and almost impossible to cross. Harley and his niece Juliana are busy cultivating a cunning solution. Years ago, Harley planted this strangler fig on the river's edge, and today he's teaching Juliana how to care for it. The fig's tangled roots help to prevent the bank being washed away. He teaches Juliana to coax the roots across what is now just a stream. When they reach the other side, they'll take hold there. This is the basis of a structure that will survive any deluge. A living bridge. It's an epic project that no man can complete in one lifetime. So Harley is passing on his knowledge to Juliana. Each year, Juliana will need to tend the roots, making them stronger. If she stays and completes her bridge, it will become part of the commuter route here. A network of dozens of living bridges that connect the valleys of Meghalaya. Some of them are many centuries old. There are even double-deckers. With Juliana to look after it, the future of this young bridge looks secure. Sustainable living architecture that will live and grow for generations.